Welcome to Technovation, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, president of Meta Strategy, advisor to technology executives, Forbes columnist, book author, and your host. Each episode of Technovation features insights from top executives and thought leaders at the intersection of business, technology, and innovation. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please subscribe so you don't miss a thing. Thank you. My guest this week is Tom Leighton. Tom's the chief executive officer of Akamai Technologies, which he co-founded with Daniel Lewin in 1998 after entering a business plan competition at MIT. Under Tom's leadership, Akamai has evolved from a content delivery network into a cloud delivery and cybersecurity platform, with revenue nearly doubling during his first 5 years in his role. As one of the world's preeminent authorities on algorithms for network applications and cybersecurity, Tom's also a professor of applied mathematics at MIT. He has published over 100 papers and holds more than 50 patents. Tom graduated summa cum laude from Princeton University in 1978 with a BSE in electrical engineering and computer science, and he received his PhD in applied mathematics from MIT in 1981. In this interview, Tom details the private and public sector's growing security concerns, which has led to the company's pivot from its traditional internet offerings to a fast-growing security business. Today, there are billions of devices in homes and offices that are not adequately secured. Bad actors have the ability to wipe out any cloud data center, which can isolate many countries from the rest of the world. Tom believes that this damage is a fraction of what could be done in future attacks, and the only way to stop these attacks is to absorb it at the edge. We also discuss Akamai's founding story, how the company survived the difficult times following the dot-com crash, why Tom believes the firewall's time has passed, and a variety of other topics. And now a word from our sponsor. Technovation is brought to you by Fortinet. I recently caught up with Fortinet's Chief Information Security Officer, Phil Quaid, and he discussed the expanding threat landscape that IT executives and companies more generally encounter daily, and the ways in which Fortinet's security fabric can help.
Almost every organization faces an expanding attack surface caused by digital transformation, threat actors that automate sophisticated attacks, and a growing cybersecurity skills gap. It's more urgent than ever for security leaders to not only be technologists, but strategists that can enable business. The fundamental elements of cybersecurity are speed and integration. Combined with segmentation and access control, you can build a foundation that tilts the odds in your favor, defending at your points of strength. Fortinet can help. Our security fabric spans your entire networked environment from the IoT endpoint through your core and into multi-cloud environments. We integrate each security element to address today's growing threat environment, protecting the expanding attack surface and reduce complexity. This enables actionable threat intelligence to be shared at speed and scale, and automated mitigations that shrink risk windows. It's the cybersecurity strategy and technology used to protect the highest end systems, and it's now accessible to both enterprise and SMB. Just because you cannot eliminate cyber risk does not mean that you cannot manage it. Build your strategy around speed, automation, and integration.
Let's get back to our interview. This interview was recorded live at an Inspire CIO event in Washington, D.C. You were a professor, of applied mathematics at MIT. I believe that's a gut course at MIT, isn't it?
Very
easy stuff. mostly football players take that, I think.
Yeah.
And so you went on with Danny Lewin to found Akamai 20 years ago, applied originally, the organization did, for a $50,000 prize at MIT, was a finalist. But the path from academics to the corporate world in the startup world isn't necessarily, especially back then, wasn't a well-hewn path. And what was it about this idea that drew you to entrepreneurship?
Well, it was a research project at MIT, and we had really no experience in business, no thought that we'd ever really create a business, but there was this business plan competition at the MIT Sloan School. And oddly enough, my graduate student, Danny Lewin, was worried about going broke from student loans. And his next door neighbor was a Sloan student. And the Sloan student said, hey, you know, let's sign up for this business plan competition. The winner gets $50,000, and that matched Danny's debt load.
Nice coincidence.
Now, he didn't know then that if you win, Oh, you don't actually get $50,000. It was $35,000, and you can't use it to pay off your student loans. But that got us, you know, into the competition, and we got books out of the library, you know, business plans for dummies, because we had no clue. But we started getting interested in, hey, the technology we're working on in the lab really could make a difference for the web. It really could help with web congestion, make the internet work faster. And as part of the competition, we met potential customers, we met experts in industry, experts in business, we learned a ton, and you know, one thing led to another, and we started the company 20 years ago.
And your original title was Chief Scientist.
Yes.
Which is interesting. What was the, can you describe the purview of a Chief Scientist? I doubt there are many people in the audience here who have Chief Scientists in their organizations.
Well, it's sort of like CTO, and Danny was the CTO. You know, initially the question was, you know, who would be the CEO of the company? You know, so Danny and I started it, and you know, I was the professor and he was the student. So we said, Tom, you should be the CEO, and I said, I have no experience in business, you know, and there's no way I can do it. We should go get a real CEO. But I asked Danny. I said, you know, he was a tremendous leader. In addition to being a brilliant mind, you know, he was a captain in the elite Israeli Defense Forces. And a fantastic leader. And so I said, I'll work for you. Why don't you be CEO? And he said, no, we should get, you know, somebody who's got real business experience. And we made our fantasy list out, and we got some really fantastic leadership from George Conrades, who'd been, you know, number two at IBM for many years. Paul Sagan, who became our second CEO, you know, had been a real leader in the tech community. So we were very fortunate to get really experienced leadership.
That's excellent. And as you developed your own business acumen that would take you down a path to, of course, eventually becoming CEO yourself, how did you gain that experience? What mentors did you leverage along the way in order to ensure that you had the appropriate experience to, in fact, rise to this role?
Well, you know, as a co-founder and on the technical side for a very technical company, I worked very closely with the CEOs, you know, George and Paul, and learned just a ton from them. And after, you know, 13 years, finally, you know, started that, you know, helped me be ready, so I felt I could become CEO. And so when Paul decided he really, really, really wanted to retire, you know, then, you know, I asked the board, I said I'd be interested in being CEO.
Yep.
So it was a long process, a lot to learn. And to this day, you know, both George and Paul are great mentors for me. Because I find I need to learn more every day.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And as the video noted as well, when you became CEO, security wasn't necessarily what the organization was known for.
Right.
It's now over $700 million of your revenue. It is the fastest growing portion of your portfolio. And talk a bit about the pivot from your traditional founding areas, the traditional product set, to now a security offering that is fast growing.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, we tried for a long time to commercialize our security capabilities, and we weren't successful. In fact, our roots in security go back all the way to 2001, you know, a few years after forming the company. Sort of an odd story, but in the summer of 2001, the Code Red virus was released, and one of the things it was designed to do was to attack the White House infrastructure on the internet. And we had no government business then, no security business, but one day the president's national security advisor showed up in our Cambridge headquarters, and we didn't know him, but somehow he knew about us, and said, we have a problem. In 2 weeks, there's going to be a massive attack on the White House and the internet infrastructure for the government, and we think you could help us, because somehow they had figured out that we have this large edge network with just a lot of servers out close to the where the users are and where the attacking bots were, and that it had enough capacity that if we directed the traffic through us, we could filter out the attack and protect the core. And so, of course, you know, we agreed, and sure enough, it stopped the Code Red attack against the White House, and that gave birth to our government business here, which has grown quite a bit, and also to our security business. But it took another, you know, decade, well, even a little bit more, until the commercial world really appreciated the challenges they were facing with DDoS attacks and application layer attacks, the loss of their, you know, private data. Probably the attacks from the Middle East on the North American banking system, where groups there could take down our banks at will, take them offline. No matter what product they bought, that was the wake-up call that enabled us to get going, because then they would turn to us. We kept them online, and that started our security business in the 2012-13 timeframe. And within a few years, it'll be our largest product area for the company.
Interesting. And you talked about the need for, as you just alluded to, better protection of the edge. This is an area of emphasis for you, that a lot more of what you're putting dollars into in terms of the development of products, and frankly, also the way in which you protect Akamai itself.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, an interesting aspect of this, is the drinking of your own champagne. You know, first and foremost, your first customer is your own company.
Yeah.
Talk a bit about that evolution as well.
You know, we've always had the thesis that the best way to deliver content on the internet and to protect the assets on the internet is through what we call an edge platform or an edge network. You know, the traditional cloud and the traditional data centers are in the core, they're in the middle. There's a relatively small number of big cloud data centers, and they have big transit pipes coming into them. The capacity there is actually very small. The vast amount of capacity on the internet is the last mile connections into the homes, into your offices, into schools. And it's at least two orders of magnitude bigger capacity out there than it is in the core. And this creates a problem when you want to deliver content, because if everybody's watching the sporting event or the news event, that creates a lot of demand out at the edge, especially now that so many countries have good last mile connectivity, and the core gets swamped. And that's why we started the company 20 years ago, is because of that. By delivering from the edge, we can actually have huge scalability and give great performance. The same is true for security. You know, today, as you all know, there's billions of devices in homes and offices that are not adequately secured, won't be. They now have access to a large amount of bandwidth because the last mile connections are strong. They actually now have good CPUs with a full communication stack. And so the bad guys can take them over, and that's a real weapon that they can use. And we see lots of them being now co-opted into bot armies. You know, and today the attacks they're launching are measured into the low single-digit terabits per second. And it's always hard to know, well, what is a terabit per second, but that's enough to wipe out any cloud data center. Most any backbone can be wiped out. Most countries, not the US, but most countries, if you direct the traffic appropriately, you can isolate the country from the rest of the world. And even though that's big, it's a fraction of what probably could be done in the attacks we'll see in the future. And the only way to stop that is to absorb it out at the edge. The same thesis for when, you know, Richard Clark visited us, you know, in 2001 and said, we got a problem, we think your edge architecture can help. Mm-hmm. And I think it's even more relevant today.
You know, one of the unfortunate realities is the bad actors are themselves quite innovative.
Yes.
And so staying current as to new approaches, new innovations, quote unquote, that they're developing must be quite an enterprise unto itself. How do you do that? How did you and your company monitor new ways or new strategies that you need to counteract?
Yeah, the bad actors, you know, are incredibly well funded. Mm-hmm. They are major governments that are highly motivated, have access to a lot of talent. It's organized crime. Mm-hmm. You know, very well funded and acts with, you know, autonomy in many parts of the world. So the adversary is very capable. And so we have to invest a ton, and we do, in both defending ourselves, because we're sort of ground zero for the attacks, and also building products to defend our customers, which are governments and banks and commerce companies and media as well. So it requires a tremendous amount of innovation, investment, work and development to be able to bring products to market to stay a step ahead. And so we do a ton of work there. We also do acquisitions of companies. Sometimes there's very cool startups. They had some clever idea that they're getting going. And so sometimes we'll do acquisitions to bring that into our platform to help our customers.
Interesting. You know, at RSA, your chief security officer delivered an address that was titled, "How Do I Get My Company to Ditch the Firewall?" And I mean, do you foresee a reality where that's actually the kid completely, ditching the firewall indeed?
Yeah.
Yeah, talk about that.
You know, it won't happen overnight. And with security, you're always hesitant to turn something off.
Uh-huh.
You know, you end up adding more and more and more. But the firewall, its time already has passed. And every time you see the latest headline of some breach, you think it can't get worse, and then you wake up this morning And you see the latest headline, like, oh my God, mm-hmm. you know, just a massive breach. How did that last for 4 years? And it's not because, you know, the CISOs or the CIOs are stupid or careless. They're smart, hardworking mm-hmm. people. They're trying very hard. But it's just hard to defend. The slightest, you know, thing goes wrong there, you're dead. There's very well-funded adversaries. And today, your own employees, no matter how much training you do, they're going to go to the wrong website, they're going to click on the wrong link, they're going to get malware on their device, they're going to authenticate themselves, traditionally today with the VPN at the network layer, they're going to be allowed in, you know, inside the moat into the castle where the goodies are. And once that happens, you know, the time for that malware to spread measured in hours, time to catch at best in months. You see the headline from today, 4 years to catch. And just the no way that defense works anymore. You gotta treat, you know, your internal applications and your internal employees the same way you would external facing apps and to the public at large. And you gotta do access at the app layer, so each application, check it, and you can't let your employee have direct connection to your internal apps, which is how it works today, yeah. almost everywhere. You know, you've got to have the full security suite in between any communication there. So an employee or device inside cannot be allowed to touch anything else inside, yeah. which basically means think of your firewall as not being there because it's not helping, really. And it's called zero trust is one popular word for it, because you can't trust anything. And everything has to be treated as if it's out in the world at large. And the good news is there are capabilities now. You know, the same kind of business we're doing to protect many of your websites and applications as it goes to the outside world, we can bring to bear internally and do authentication at the app layer to provide a zero trust architecture. You know, at Akamai today, a decent fraction of our employees no longer use the VPN within less than a year. None of them will use the VPN for our internal applications. And I think you'll see more and more of that, you know, happen. The good news is it'll save money. Mm. It'll be a lot simpler. You won't have these gigantic network costs, you know, for the private networks. You won't have to be fortifying massive data center build-outs, which is already, it's too late, just the volume of attacks can swamp them. You know, it'll all be, you know, in the cloud, but in a much more secure way. Hmm.
You talked a bit about some of the areas in which you're investing, some of the realities you see coming to pass internally. What else do you have planned? As you look out, say, 5 years, what are some of the areas that particularly excite you, trends you're hoping to ride, areas in which you're investing?
You know, we're doing a lot of investment around security. In 5 years, for sure, it'll be our biggest business, you know, by far. And by 5 years, probably a lot of you won't have traditional firewalls anymore. I think, you know, things always move slower than sort of the technologist thinks. You know, I think there's a lot of interest in blockchain. You know, we're engaged with, not so much in the US, I would say, but in other governments around the world that we're engaged on projects there. Moving to digital currencies, there's an interest in, you know, making sure the governments get their tax revenue, slowing down the you know, the gray market or the black market, you know, in many countries in the world. IoT, you know, in its infancy, there is a big challenge with billions of devices that aren't secured, you know, and in that time frame, you know, I think it's certainly our goal is to be able to funnel communications from those devices into a security layer to keep them from doing damage and also try to help protect them from, you know, getting infected. Identity management is a very interesting area, you know, going forward. Mm-hmm. Obviously from the security perspective, but also privacy of information is, you know, really important. And obviously we have a lot of public discussion about that now here and elsewhere around the world. Very interesting area.
Yeah, very interesting indeed. I would also be interested in your perspectives on how you maintain the entrepreneurial spirit in your organization now that you are a behemoth. You were there at the founding, you were there when it was just a couple of people, and now it's quite a bit larger. How do you keep it fresh? How do you ensure that the organization's not building red tape where you won't, you know, where decisions can't happen as fast, where innovations and opportunities can't be seized as readily?
You gotta work really hard at it and make it a major priority. When you're a startup, it's obviously easy to have entrepreneurial spirit. That's just what it is. As you get bigger, invariably red tape comes in, bureaucracy comes in. people get nervous about presenting a crazy idea. There's more people who can say no. And so you have to put a lot of emphasis on giving good ideas oxygen, you know, helping them grow and have mechanisms to do it. You know, there's no shortage of people who have good ideas at Akamai. There's more good ideas today than there were when we started because there's more, you know, smart, you know, entrepreneurial-minded employees. The trouble is the infrastructure around it. So we do a bunch of things. You know, we have a company-wide business plan competition, like what started Akamai. You know, and this year we had about 800 entries. We put them up on a wiki. Employees can contribute to each other. We have judging for it. Mm-hmm. So in another week, we'll be doing the final round of the 10 best. Senior management will judge the winners. We will fund them. That comes with it, that we're going to fund the ideas. And it's made a big difference to us in the past. You know, the winners have started business lines for us. Including part of the Zero Trust that we started working on several years ago. Part of that came out of this competition. And in fact, one of the ideas had been nixed lower down in the organization. We have, in every major office, we have tech jams. In fact, just yesterday we had the judging for Tech Jam in Cambridge, where anybody who wants can take 48 hours and code whatever they want. And then it's presented in a science fair. And then, you know, the executives all join the team and we'll judge and we'll name winners. But everybody has a good time and they do cool things, and even things that don't win are going to get implemented. And some of them were just great ideas. 2 weeks ago, I was in Tel Aviv. I judged, you know, the one there. They have very cool work going on in security, and it's a fantastic ways for ideas to get exposure and then to get implemented, and it can short circuit the time to be months to years. Mm-hmm. But you have to put these mechanisms in place. The senior executives have to engage. You know, and it's so important because tech moves so fast that if you don't do it in tech, you can be dead before you say oops.
Mm-hmm. You as a CEO and as an executive across the years at Akamai have worked with a number of CIOs as customers. You've also had your own CIOs, needless to say. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, how you see the role of CEO to CIO, how it has evolved, how you see it working in this day and age. And especially, I always find it really interesting, CIOs of technology companies, and a lot of the organizations that are represented here, the overwhelming majority of tech talent is in IT. Obviously, that's not the case in an organization like Akamai, where technology is everywhere. And so differentiating oneself in terms of as a CIO and contributing a different level of value or a different kind of value, it becomes that much more important. I wonder if you could share some insights into what you see as the sort of the true value or the evolving value of the CIO in an organization like Akamai, as well as maybe some of the best of what you've seen among your customers.
Yeah, well, part of it is, you know, digital business transformation. The mm-hmm. world is moving so fast, so it's not just a job of keeping the lights on, you know, but really moving the company infrastructure forward so the company could be a lot more effective. And at Akamai, and you mentioned this earlier, you know, it's drinking our own champagne, mm-hmm. you know, and our business is often the first to use our new products. And we do it in a very safe way, and of course the deployed platform is always kept very different than our, you know, internal employee infrastructure. But it's trying it out, getting the feedback to the product teams early, you know, and that's very important for us because we are the test case for what we're going to be selling to our customers, and it's really great to get that feedback, you know, from the CIO organization. So the CIO is a major business partner in a variety of ways at Akamai.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. You know, we've mentioned Danny Lewin a few times, a key person obviously at the founding of the organization. Tragically, 3 years after its founding, he passed away in the 9/11 attacks. And I wonder what was the transition from that, to recovering from somebody, a loss like that, somebody so important, so unexpectedly passing away. I wonder if you could reflect on that for a moment.
Well, obviously a horrible time, you know. Mm-hmm. Danny was like the heart and soul and leader of the company. And, you know, to be, you know, killed on September 11th was devastating. At the same time, you know, on that day, you know, it was just chaos, you know, in the country, people mm-hmm. desperate for news. And, you know, when you have big events like that, a lot of the bad actors come out mm-hmm. in force. And so a lot of the folks here experienced that as government sites were attacked. And it became even harder to get the news out. First, you got lots of people coming to the sites to get information. You got the attackers coming there trying to do harm. So it was the biggest, you know, day in terms of need for our employees to help customers that we'd had. And so we're in tremendous grief, and yet we've got to work, you know, three times as hard to help our government customers, you know, get online. A lot of them hadn't been customers, became customers that day with emergency integrations, you know, to help them withstand, you know, the legitimate traffic and the attack traffic. So it was really a brutal period, you know, for the company. It was, in some ways, you know, Danny's vision was fulfilled, that we were able to help so many government sites at the time. But following that, of course, we're having the dot-com crash. You know, over the next couple of years, we were laying off two-thirds of our employees. We nearly were went broke. A lot of our customers went broke. So very, very dark days. And that's, you know, where the character of the people that worked at Akamai really, you know, carried the day.
Yeah.
The technology was great, but it was the people that withstood all that adversity and worked extra hard to bring the company through that period that made the difference.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot that's been written, I think very compellingly, about the change of competition from company to company to ecosystem to ecosystem. And it strikes me, you are a great person to talk to the balance between the relationship between enterprise and academics, as somebody who has a foot in both both worlds. You're, I think, officially still on leave from MIT. I don't know if they've gotten the hint yet that you've got something else you've been focusing on. But I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that. I know you still remain very involved at MIT. In fact, your offices are just a few stones throw from your other office at MIT. Still, of course, have a talent pool that you're drawing from, inspiration that you're drawing from in terms of research that's being conducted at the university level. Can you talk a bit about that sort of enterprise to university relationship?
Well, I think there's tremendous value, at least for a technology company, to have strong relationships with academic institutions. Mm-hmm. A lot of the talent is coming from there. There's folks doing research. There's a lot of innovative ideas. I think on the other side, leading tech industry can help the academics. You know, they're looking to work on relevant problems, and heavens knows that we've got some really big challenges, you know, on the corporate side, especially you look at cybersecurity. Mm. A lot of work needs to be done there. And so at Akamai, we do have a very close relationship with several universities, including MIT. In our case, our headquarters is a block away. There's a lot of back and forth. I do give lectures every other fall. In fact, there was something in the video clip at the chalkboard still at MIT. And it's a chance to, you know, bring the real world to the classroom, bring the students and the faculty into the real world. And I think that's a very good thing for both sides to do. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, I spend all my time at Akamai. You know, being CEO is more than a full-time job. But having a close connection, I think, is very worthwhile. And I do that instead of serving on other corporate boards, which most CEOs do. And it's about the same time commitment.
Interesting. Well, we'll leave it there. Won't you join me in thanking Dr. Tom Leighton for this great conversation? Well done.
Thank you
so much. Thanks for tuning in, and please join me next week when my guest will be Elizabeth Hackinson, the Chief Information Officer of Schneider Electric.